You're listening to the Study Legal English podcast, the world's first legal English podcast, helping lawyers and law students become fluent in legal English. Hello and welcome to the Study Legal English podcast. I'm your host, Louise, and today I've got a very special guest on the show. It's Christopher Rathbone. Chris is a Canadian attorney who has been living and working in Tokyo for many years. Chris works with the law firm City Yua Partners in Tokyo. He's a law professor at Temple University Japan Law School, where he teaches a range of subjects, including legal translation and legal writing skills, with a particular focus on plain language. He also speaks on topics such as the use of plain English and the legal profession. And interestingly, he's currently working as the executive producer for the motion picture film Stay. So clearly a man of many talents. And I got in touch with Chris because an acquaintance of mine who I did some legal English training with a few years ago, Jeff Heisman, liked a post on LinkedIn about Chris running a workshop on persuasive legal writing. I saw this and I thought, this looks very interesting. I'd like to have an interview with Chris, and here we are. So today I'm interviewing him on Skype. He's in Japan, I'm in Italy, and we're going to focus on using plain English in legal writing. So Chris, welcome. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Good. So let's go into the questions. Chris, you're an advocate of writing in plain English. What are the general principles of plain English?
Well, some people take the approach of basing it on what I would call certain suggestions to improve writing. But I would say it's really actually more of a process of focusing on dedication, inoculation, simplicity, and clarity. And so the dedication is first, which strangely a lot of people don't do this, but it's basically considering how to effectively communicate to the reader. And it's deciding basically that you're going to work at doing that, because it's not a simple task. And then the inoculation part is very unique to the legal world, because normally what you would hope, like let's say, you know, a profession where you could do it, like journalism, is you would pick up the style from reading pieces of journalism and say, well, that's a good piece of journalism. I'll try to use that style or try to copy that person. But in law, more than likely, that would lead you in a bad direction, because unfortunately, plain English principles are only just recently being widely applied in law. So in law, you have to be able to read very poorly written material, particularly from the viewpoint of plain English, but not absorb that style, which is kind of difficult. The focus then would be then on simplicity and clarity. And I think that's a psychological issue to overcome, because the thing that people would want to do in law is you want to impress people. Mm. You don't want to seem to be simplistic. However, by removing all the redundant, irrelevant parts, people will appreciate that. And then the final goal being clarity, everyone would agree on that. Even the people who don't adopt plain English, they can't really argue with clarity. You know, I usually give my students, when I start off, I have an interview between Brian Gardner and Chief Justice Roberts of mm-hmm. the Supreme Court. And my goal there is to show that this is really not some kind of out there goal adopted by, you know, people who are
radical,
not part of the mainstream. Everybody wants clarity. There's no question about that. They may have some different ideas how to do it. And then the other place where I would say people go wrong in terms of legal writing mm-hmm. in a broad sense, because I'm going to include drafting in that, but it still applies, because I would say the goal is you want to write for as much as possible for like an ordinary reader. So you don't want to assume that they have like some special vocabulary. The most abused thing from the viewpoint of lawyers is they'll always say, well, I'm writing this because a judge would like this, or this seems to be legal somehow. Not realizing, as Brian Garner points out, and this also has been pointed out in other work, which is work that's full of legalese is looked upon poorly. It's looked upon as not being written by people who are the best educated people in the profession. Basically, that's kind of where I start from in my classes, because, you know, this is the problem I faced in law school, because I took legal writing. And they address this very briefly. They say, yeah, don't write in the passive voice, but there's no background, there's no context. You just get this list of writing tips.
Yeah.
And they never really tell you, like, well, where is this coming from? Why would I do that? Nobody ever really explained it. It wasn't until I read Brian Garner's text, Legal Writing in Plain English, that I understood it by reading the introduction. And, of course, that's a huge problem as well, because normally people don't want to read introductions. I think it's really important to start from that point.
Yeah, and you've kind of answered this question, but why are you an advocate of plain English?
Well, I just think it's a better approach in that it's very practical in that you get much better results. And I have an extra thing, which is I do a lot of proofreading of work of Japanese lawyers. If you simplify from the beginning, you're going to have less error. There's less potential to make mistakes. So for people who are not native speakers, I would say there's an additive incentive, because you're not going to be using all these kind of quirky kinds of phrases and things that you wouldn't normally use. Mm. And therefore, the potential to make mistakes is decreased. So that will look much better. There's nothing less sophisticated than having a lot of word usage mistakes and grammar mistakes in your writing. But then there's also, invariably, what happens is that important facts don't come out. Important arguments are not made, because anything that's not written from a plain language perspective is going to be kind of mushy. And then from the viewpoint of drafting, I would say it's extremely important, because ultimately, the people using the contract, the people using the rules, will not understand what they're about, and you'll have disputes. I think the overwhelming thing, and I think this is why, finally, basically from the 1980s, that lawyers began to adopt this, is people don't have time to read huge, wordy documents. And the more you simplify it, the happier they are, right? The better, you know, the faster they can read through it and get the information. You know, perhaps if you only have a few page contract, if it's written in a very kind of archaic style, which is hard to understand, well, you know, it's not ideal, but it's just a couple of pages. But if that's like 100 pages, then, you know, not following plain language rules will make it a really grueling task to go through all of it. So I think those are the key things why I advocate it.
And talking about this, people don't really have the time or the concentration nowadays to focus on really long documents. One of the tendencies in sort of legalese heavy documents or archaic documents can be to have these really long sentences that go on and on and on, not very much punctuation or loads of punctuation, whereas the plain English style would be to have shorter sentences, much more understandable. What tips can you give writers to try to reduce their sentence length?
Well, I mean, the basic thing is it's really starting from having a proper framework. So oftentimes these failures are the result of not thinking through the writing at first. And that's particularly important for legal writing, but also important in legal drafting. So you have to think out the whole structure of the document. And then I would say that the golden rule for plain English is always omit needless words. Or expressed in a positive form, you say make every word count. So once you kind of get started on that, proper paragraphing first, then from proper paragraphing, you look at kind of structuring the sentences. So the paragraph internally has a good flow, which would naturally be better to have primarily shorter sentences. The thing that lawyers have that almost nobody else has is that they don't keep subjects and verbs together. In a way, it's kind of an advantage, because often in my classes, people don't have any legal training. And they're often much easier to teach, because then I'll just skip over that, because I'll say, well, you haven't had an opportunity to develop this horrible habit in the first place.
Yeah, there's a tendency to use very strange grammatical structures in legal English, which are absolutely not necessary. I've got an example of a couple of sentences that I wrote. One which is quite kind of heavy, wordy sentence that could feature, for example, in a badly drafted contract. I'll read it now. Within no more than 7 days of receipt of payment due by buyer to seller, goods will be delivered by said seller to said buyer. Whereas if we imagined writing that in a plain English way, we could say something like, the seller will deliver the goods to the buyer within 7 days of payment. And if we compare those two sentences, the first one's 25 words, written in the passive voice, using these words like said, extra words which are not particularly necessary, whereas the second one uses just 14 words, it's written in the active voice. We've talked about this active and passive voice. Why do you think lawyers tend to use this passive voice? Is there a time when the passive voice should be used?
Well, first of all, I think what has been identified by Brian Gardner is most lawyers cannot consistently recognize what the passive voice is. So there's the first problem. So I had kind of advantaged that because, like, I studied Latin in high school, so I kind of understood the grammatical structure that way. But even so, it's just a compounding thing, because that tends to be what they read. They read things where there's a lot of passive voice. Interestingly, formal Japanese relies very heavily on passive voice. They use it quite a lot. I would say in a kind of the bureaucratic language, it has the advantage of avoiding to take responsibility for anything yourself.
Yeah.
Because the subject becomes unknown. But I would say the reason to use it, because it's interesting, because I listened to something, a critique of that, because, I mean, that was the golden rule, but then some people have kind of reacted against it. Well, like anything in plain English, it's, first of all, a suggestion. It's not a rule. It's a way to make your writing better. It's not grammatically incorrect to use the passive voice. It's just generally wordy. So that's the first problem. And the second problem, I would say the syntax of it doesn't meet your expectation. Mm-hmm. So when people talk in English, most people are not speaking in a passive voice. But, I mean, there are times when it is used. And I would say the important one for lawyers is where it could be useful is particularly when you're writing like a fact statement and you want to ever so much nuance it so as to favor your position. So you kind of want to hide the identity of the actor. You want to focus on the act and not the actor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that's a key one. The other one is in terms of having good sentence structure, which is to end sentences emphatically. So if what you want to emphasize in the sentence, you want to put that at the end, you may need to use a passive structure to do it. And then the other way it's also good in the modern world is to avoid sexist language.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're removing the subject, it's also another way to limit the potential for using having sexist language.
Okay, and another feature in, for example, contracts, even just generally in legal writing, which we've mentioned, these redundant words. Very often we have doublets, triplets of synonyms, which mean two words with pretty much the same meaning. For example, each and every, free and clear, full and complete. We very often hear these. Do you have any tips to avoid these? I mean, I guess just eliminate them. Do you have any other tips to avoid them?
Well, one of the things you could do is you could run kind of a bracketed search on Google, and then you can see really what kind of contracts it's coming out of. If you see some kind of phrasing, if you search it, you can often see, oh, well, these are contracts which are full of legalese. They're not really good examples. They're not what I want. Fortunately, that's one of the things that is refreshing about the Japanese, because in the Japanese language, they don't have all these synonyms for law. And it's actually often a challenge for Japanese translators, because they come up against these doublets and triplets. What are you going to do if you have a give, devise, and bequeath? Those are exact same things. And so how are you going to express that in Japanese, where their legal vocabulary is, I guess, in a way, it's more exact, or it's more limited because they don't have all these synonyms? I recommend that they just use the one word when they translate it, because you don't lose anything in the meaning.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you studied Latin at school. Lucky you, though I'm sure that makes you very good at languages, or at least romance-based languages. What's your take on using Latin in legal English? Because, of course, there are lots of Latinisms.
You know, of course, as I said, this is another point where it's not exactly hard and fast, because they say to avoid jargon, and there's nothing that's more jargon than Latin. Particularly, you know, the Japanese get really fascinated by the, like, things like inter alia, among other things, which in of itself is like, it's a double crime, because first of all, it's Latin. Mm-hmm. And then when you translate it into English, it's needless words. I think that's a lot of the Latin. You know, there are things like habeas corpus, those kind of things, which are what they call terms of art. In other things, there's like actus reus and mens rea. I don't think there's any reason to have that. You could just call it mens rea. You could just call it mental element. Actus reus, it's just the physical elements of the crime. I don't think it really adds anything. This is why, another reason why things progress so slowly in law, because once you train people to make distinctions, even if they're completely arbitrary kind of distinctions, they're going to make distinctions. You know, that's always most of what I usually see where people write something and they say, well, I don't think these plain language people, they don't know what's going on and they don't properly express themselves. I think a lot of it is just ridiculous nitpicking. I don't think they have any point. There's, as I said, like something like habeas corpus, there you're talking about like a criminal procedure, has a complex history and everything like that. That one would be difficult to replace. Actus reus, I don't really see any point. And then once again, that's also like an inoculation thing, because obviously, as a lawyer, you would have to be able to understand that if you're reading cases. You have to know some Latin to a certain extent, because you know, you can't be just looking up everything as you're reading it. I don't want to be defended by a criminal lawyer who doesn't know what the mens rea, what's that?
No.
Yeah, I don't really, but then again, if they want to speak to a client, I don't think it's adding any value to use all these terms that nobody has any idea what they mean. And I guess the important point always is that they have a very precise, everyday kind of equivalent.
Just something that I was thinking of is that for non-native English-speaking lawyers or law students, writing or speaking in plain English when you're dealing with the law is quite difficult. And perhaps even though it's simple language, you have to have such a grasp of the legal concepts in the first place that actually plain language could require a more advanced level of English than simply writing in the legalese style. And perhaps that's why legalese and these kind of archaic pieces of legal writing are so prevalent. What do you think about that?
Definitely. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I would say that's a reason why it continues to be used, because, as I said, that's why I said at the beginning, because you have to start with the idea of being dedicated to do it. Because it's not an easy process. That's what's really so deceptive about it.
Yeah.
It's easy to read. It's not easy to write. And the easier way to do it is just to copy that. And for example, like if you use something like therefore with no E on the end, what are you actually referring to? It's easier just to throw in the hereto or the where or the therefore.
Aforementioned. hereinafter.
Not have to think through what it is that you're exactly referring to.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it legalese language is much less precise. It tends to persist. That's just the easier way to do it.
Speaking about legalese, is there a time when it's a good idea to use legalese?
That depends on how you're defining it. First of all, you'd have to draw the line where you say some things are a term of art, you can't really change it, and some things have everyday equivalence. I would say the more persistent or horrible, you know, is these kind of things like the constant repetition of, among other things, you know, so inter alia, these kind of things which are totally meaningless, or writing in the event that instead of writing if. The jargon itself is not particularly like a huge problem. Let's say you're writing about mens rea. Well, somebody could look that up in a dictionary for the one time it comes up. But, you know, if you constantly are writing in this very kind of wordy way, really archaic kind of Latin and all this other kind of stuff, it's just annoying. And then one of the rules, although this is not a hard and fast rule, but a lot of people suggest not using shall. In Japan, that's a really hard sell because the first thing anytime they have any kind of course in contract drafting, which is basically just a course in legalese, they've had that drummed into them. So I would at least try to like explain to them, okay, well, let's say you're saying it's very strong and powerful because it shows like an obligation. Why would you need it for this agreement shall be governed by Japanese law? Why would you need that shall? They'll usually agree with that. They'll go, oh, well, yeah, I kind of see your point. That's not necessary. So you got to kind of like break
them
off of it. Because as I said, that's basically the few Japanese courses that I've seen about contract drafting contain all this kind of misinformation. People see that, as I said, part of the process of inoculation, people see that, they're impressed by that. They think, well, that's must be what it is to write a good contract.
Yeah, that's the way. I suppose in that example you gave, you could just write, this contract is governed by...
Exactly.
When you can replace the strange legal words, do. And another thing that plain English tries to get rid of is these nominalizations. So where nouns are used instead of verbs. For example, if I read a sentence with a nominalization, an example would be, I refer to my client's citing of the meeting on the 4th of September, instead of saying a plain English version without a nominalization, which would be, my client cited the meeting on the 4th of September. Can you give it a better definition of nominalizations than I have, Chris, or how to spot them, how to avoid them?
Usually what you're talking about there is what they call the buried verb. Yeah. And so usually that has a shun or a meant in it. And it's also related to another rule which people have a hard time keeping with, which is to avoid to be verbs.
Hmm.
That's usually related. So instead of meet with somebody, you have a meeting. It all relates back to the fundamental rule of omit needless words.
Yes.
So that's kind of the rule. And then these things like avoiding the nominalizations is a process of how to achieve that. So that's really why I said I like among all the texts out there, I mean, the one I'm most familiar with, easiest to use, is Brian Gardner's Legal Writing in Plain English, because he not only talks about plain English, but he uses all the rules himself in writing the book. So
it's like the Bible of plain English, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess what Brian Gardner suggests is, you take the word count and then you try to remove, like, I would say maybe 30% or something like that. Mm-hmm. Try to reduce the amount of words that you're using. And that this avoiding of nominalization is just one of the methods to get to that goal.
Yeah, yeah. So it could be redundant words. It could be these nominalizations. It could be this the active passive structure, a number of things. Good. Okay, so we're almost done. Just a couple more questions. Firstly, do you have any other final tips for clearer legal writing? We've covered quite a lot. Don't know if there's any others that we've missed.
I think the one that is the easiest for people to understand is the idea of making it speakable. If you wouldn't say it, don't write it. And it's very easy. I got a very good example of this, which is basically, you know, when I go to Starbucks with my friend, if I'm in a generous mood, I don't announce to them before they get their coffee. I can say, the price of the coffee shall be borne by me. You know? And nobody says that. You know, nobody. And once you point that out, then people are like, oh, yeah, that sounds really stupid.
Yeah.
But when it looks impressive, maybe, I guess, when you write it. But when you say it, it sounds really stupid. You just say, I will pay for the coffee.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that's always a good kind of final measure. You know, I mean, that goes back to the passive, because I said when people speak, they don't use the passive. Mm. When people speak, they don't have a huge separation between the subject of the sentence and the verb. But I think as a final check, it's always worth reading what you've written out loud, particularly for like a non-native speakers. I think that's a very useful point.
Yeah, good point. So finally, the final question is something that could be helpful for legal English teachers who listen to the podcast, but also for students as well. You've mentioned some of the resources that you use. You mentioned Brian Garner's book. When you're teaching your courses at the university, are there any other resources that you rely on or something that you find useful?
Yeah, Brian Garner's Legal Writing in Plain English. And then if you want something that's a little more advanced and a little less kind of structured, is also Brian Garner's The Winning Brief, which that's more focused towards, that doesn't contain the stuff about legal drafting. It's basically focused towards persuasive legal writing. That's another excellent book. And then I also encourage, like, there's some justices that have very good writing that way. One, I would say, for the British, it would be Lord Denning.
Mm-hmm.
I think his judgments are very kind of written very clearly, powerful. I mean, because I had a contract professor who thought he was, like, the worst the worst justice ever, because he basically kind of ruined the law. But his writing was good. I won't fault him on that. And then I think for the United States, I think one of the really great justices that way is Benjamin Cardozo.
Uh-huh.
If you read like Paul's Graf or Wood versus Lady Duff Gordon, good writers have always really followed these kind of ideas. They've always tried to do these things. And so that's also pointed out in Brian Garner's Legal Writing in Plain English. This is nothing new. This has been going on for like 100 years.
Mm, good. Very good. Okay, so that brings us to the end of the show. So thank you for coming on the show, Chris.
Thank you.
And if you listeners out there would like more information about the courses that Chris teaches, head over to Temple University's website at www.tuj.ac.jp. And you can also connect with or follow Chris on LinkedIn. He very often posts interesting things, and that's how I found him. So thank you for listening. Don't forget to head over to studylegalenglish.com to find out more information about this episode, including links to anything we've mentioned today. And of course, if you liked the episode, share it, send it to your lawyer friends, and of course, make sure you're writing in plain English. Send me a comment to info@studylegalenglish.com. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.